This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection, and I'll introduce my guest shortly. But I want to continue on this little journey I've been taking our listeners to about thinking and arguing effectively and listening to arguments. And remember, I think it's most important to remember, if you're listening to an argument, what's the evidence and what's the logic being used? When you look at logic, there are a number of comments or statements people make that may seem to be logical, but on further examination are not, and those are called logical fallacies, and I have been mentioning a number of those, starting with people who have a lot of authority may make comments, and it may be assumed that just because they're an authority or well-known that that makes them right, and that is not – that's a logical fallacy, does not necessarily follow at all. A non sequitur is logical arguments that don't follow. Doesn't matter how sincere someone is, you have to listen to what they say. We've talked about how something follows closely in sequence, may seem to be related, but may not at all. And we've talked about coincidence and causality and things that are close in time do not even mean that they're causal in relationship. Last week we talked about what's called an ad hominem argument, where the person may, instead of addressing another person's logical argument, they may attack the person or the thought and not really address the issue at all. And today I want to mention an argument, our logical fallacy called ad ignoratum. That's an argument where ignorance, which means basically that the person is stating that the belief is true because we don't know that it isn't true. For example, someone who believes in extrasensory perception might say that we don't understand that extrasensory perception is true because we don't know everything there is to know about the human brain, for example. Another common example of this is intelligent design, where one of the core arguments of intelligent design is that there's biological structures that have not been fully explained by evolutionary theory, so therefore the powerful intelligent designer must have created them. Another perfectly good example or explanation for intelligent design is maybe that there's the transitional fossils that lead credence to the evolutionary theory have not been found. And in fact, I think the evidence keeps accumulating that more and more of these transitional fossils that have been suspiciously predicted are now being found adds more evidence to the strength of the evolutionary therapy, at least as in response to this argument by intelligent design. So remember, keep thinking about what's the evidence and what's the logic of the argument that you're being asked to listen to. However, today we're going to be talking about sleep disorders and sleep problems with a specialist. My guest is Dr. Ron Cates. He's joining us from by telephone from Athens, Texas. He's a board-certified sleep specialist. He graduated from the University of Texas Health Sciences Center in Houston, went on to practice family medicine for a number of years before getting interested in family medicine, is now completely board-certified and runs his own freestanding sleep center in Athens, Texas. But in addition, he's also associated with the Alaska Sleep Clinic here in Anchorage, who has facilities both in Anchorage and Fairbanks and Wasilla. And it's a real pleasure to get to talk about sleep problems again. Dr. Cates, welcome to Line One.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I guess initial first question that always comes to mind is we certainly are hearing more and more and more about sleep and its associated disorders, especially over, I guess, the last 10 to 15 years or so. Why might that be, for example? What are we now is driving this kind of interest?
I think there's several different things that go into that answer. First of all, the technology has progressed enough where we finally got treatments, and we've got ways to analyze people and assess their situation and their problems with all the digital computer world things that have come together. That's allowed us to take the science of sleep and actually make it commercialized where we can offer it to patients, and it's not just strictly in the medical centers and the big research areas. So that's made a big difference. And as it's come into the community, people have now become aware of it. And the more people are aware of it, the more they talk about it, and the more they actually say, well, maybe I've got a problem. And the other big thing is the connection that's been made with all the research. Lots of money's going to research, but there's connections being made to other aspects of our health. You know, sleep mm-hmm. is one-third of our existence, and it seems to have a significant interaction with several different medical disorders that we're all aware of, like hypertension, heart attack, strokes, diabetes. So everybody's becoming more aware of it. And the last reason, I believe, is because in general the society is becoming heavier, more obese. And as obesity becomes a bigger problem, a lot of sleep disorders become bigger problems.
Okay, so the technology has allowed us to look at sleep and its associated problems much more easily, and we're basically finding that there's a lot more association than we ever assumed might be there, especially with some of the chronic diseases.
Absolutely. You know, when I first got into sleep medicine back in around 2000, there were just some conjectures about a lot of associations. We knew there was a definite association with hypertension, but the rest were just conjectures, kind of like you were just talking about, not really the strong evidence there. But now it's becoming pretty definite that there is a connection with hypertension and atrial fibrillation and strokes and diabetes. All that's fairly new.
All right. We're going to, just for those listeners, we're going to get into a lot of the specific disorders that are being elucidated and suggest some treatments that may be available. So if you have questions, however, why don't you begin to think about writing those down? And let me tell you how you can get a hold of us during the next hour to ask your questions. You can do it either by telephone or you can email us. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number for those of you outside of Anchorage at 1-888-353-5752. And email me during the next 58 minutes or so at lineone, lineone, all one word, at kska.org. And remember, of course, if you're listening between 7 and 8 Anchorage time tonight, that's a taped rebroadcast. It's only between 2 and 3 that we're here in the studio or on the telephone to answer your questions directly. Well, another fundamental question is why does sleep exist? It seems like it's certainly at least in vertebrates, and it's a universal process that seems to have dated back for a long, long period of evolutionary history. But what's the purpose? Why does sleep need to be done?
You want to know the short answer to that? The short answer is we don't know.
Yes, I suspected that was maybe part of it. But what are the thoughts? It's a fascinating question, and also the same question is going to come up about dreaming, which may have the same answer too. But
the actual scientific reason is not clear as to what it is about the brain and the rest of the body that makes it require sleep. The things that seem obvious, though, is that we get restoration both of our muscles and our energy and our strength and our brain as far as our abilities to think and be rational and make decisions and reflexively respond to things like when we're driving and whatever. This certainly is a strong connection with memory. You know, without sleep, we have a real hard time with memory because that's when it's consolidated and placed into a format that we can use and recall later to do stuff. There seems to be connections with our immune system. Without proper sleep, our immune system is weakened. As a matter of fact, when we get sick, certain chemicals are released that actually make us sleepy because sleep will help our immune system. So there's just a huge list of reasons why we have to sleep, and we really don't understand how that happens, that everything is fixed and why we have to do it.
So it kind of, in a general sense, we're beginning to understand it's, again, this mind-body duality that's important. As we begin to understand more and more about the brain, perhaps we'll understand more and more specifics. But there seems to be a very complex interaction between the mind and the body in other ways, and sleep fits into that picture in some way. Is that fair to say, I guess?
I believe so. You bet.
What about another way to think about why sleep is important is what happens without sleep? You mentioned the immune system, but there's certainly been a number of studies that looked at sleep deprivation and what happens. Could you inform us a little bit on that?
Okay. And sleep deprivation, I think, is a fascinating area in our field. There's lots of ongoing studies and things looking at sleep deprivation because our society overall is sleep deprived. In fact, there was one single thing historically that started the onset of sleep deprivation for our society. You want to guess what that was?
No.
Let me tell you. It's the invention of the light bulb. When the light bulb was invented, it seems that at that point, people quit going to bed when the sun went down, and the proper amount of sleep started failing people. Since then, our lives get faster, our days get longer, our jobs become more than one, they may be two and three, and there's chores to take care of when both parents come home from work. So the days are long, and everybody gets deprived of sleep. Sleep deprivation's a bad thing. It leads to all kinds of issues. Some of the more definite things that we see on a daily basis up here is people with sleep deprivation, there's a connection with development of diabetes from sleep deprivation, with the metabolic syndrome. There's a connection to obesity, because when we don't get enough sleep, the body assumes it's under attack, basically. And there's a couple of chemicals in our body, enzymes, that will change their balance, and it increases our appetite for carbohydrates, of all things. But it needs the quick energy, so we prefer carbohydrates, and then we're storing it away because we're basically under attack, so we're storing it away for when we need it. So obesity is connected with sleep deprivation. Reflexes, an interesting little fact is that if somebody has been without sleep for 18 hours, which, you know, we all do fairly frequently because that means that's a day where you only get 6 hours of sleep. You've been up for 18 hours. Your reflexes, when they test you in a test environment, are no better than somebody who is legally intoxicated. Mm-hmm. Isn't that an interesting thing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just from sleep deprivation.
Mm-hmm.
Our abilities to remember things go down. Our abilities to respond and use good judgment go down.
The connection between decreased sleep and obesity is interesting. What I heard you say, or my interpretation, was that lack of sleep is actually a stressful situation, so that it's much like a stress situation where there may be increased hormones such as cortisol that may lead to this obesity and carbohydrate intolerance. Is that kind of the issue you're trying to discuss there?
Well, cortisol is an absolute different area, but yes, it's all in the same environment. It's actually the hormones are leptin and ghrelin are the two that are involved in this particular process.
Right. Okay. All right. We have a email that I think we'll go ahead and address. It's a pretty common question. It comes from a listener named Ashley, and she says she's 28 years old and found out in the last 2 years that she is a sleepwalker. She says, I thought this was more of a nuisance until I walked outside in my sleep during a very cold February night in Fairbanks. The scariest part of being a sleepwalker is that I have no recollection of what's happening. So I guess what she's asking you to discuss sleepwalking, and I'll let you do that. And then if there's some other issues about sleepwalking that I may ask about if you don't address those. So what would you tell her?
Okay. Well, Ashley, I'm sorry that's going on with you, and that's a dangerous situation, so I'm glad you're looking into it. Let me tell you a little bit about sleepwalking. The medical term for that is somnambulism, meaning walking in the sleep. This happens during non-REM sleep, and we're eventually going to talk about the difference in REM and non-REM, but the phase of sleep where we don't do our most prominent dreaming is what we call non-REM. During that phase of sleep, that's when we're in light sleep and deep sleep. Start off light, go into deep. And most of us, as we age, our brains will go ahead and mature. And when we shift from being asleep to wake or wake to sleep, the brain will follow that and the body will follow that all together. And that all happens together. And the reason I say something about maturity of the brain is because we see sleepwalking in children a lot, and it's not a very uncommon thing. The thing about sleepwalking in children is they usually outgrow it. By the age of 12 or so, the sleepwalking usually goes away. And the tendency to do that tends to run in families. So if you've got a brother or a dad or an uncle or somebody that tends to sleepwalk, then that's probably why you have the tendency for that. What will happen is as somebody goes to sleep, their brain, their body all starts subsiding equally together into the phases of sleep. But then if something should suddenly disrupt their sleep and make them try to shift, what happens is their body may wake up. The portion of their brain that helps their body to get up and ambulate and do things, but the other aspect of the brain that went to sleep, their conscious brain, may not wake up, and they continue in a sleep phase. And when we test those people and they're up and about, we'll actually see the brain wave still in a sleep mode, but they're walking around doing things. In a child that's doing that, what we do is we just try to protect them and make sure that the doors are locked, the windows are locked, they can't walk out on the street or whatever. When you get a little older, it becomes more dangerous because you know how to reach those higher locks, and you've got keys to the car, and there's been lots of situations where people go out driving in their sleep, and they don't find out till later where they are or what's going on. And there's even been cases where there's been murders, and people weren't aware that they did it, and they've been acquitted, by the way. So there's all kinds of complex activities that can go on. The things that kind of stand out in what you're talking about is this activity usually happens in the first part of the night rather than the last part of the night. So maybe if you go to bed at 10, the activity is going to happen around midnight or 1 or 2. It's when you drop into your deeper sleep, because most of our deep sleep is in the early part of the night rather than the late part of the night. Most often, the people have no recall whatsoever the next day that they did any of that. Most often when you talk to these people, if you try to wake them up and talk sense to them, there's nobody home. They won't respond to you. They won't follow your directions. And if you do manage to wake them up, they're usually confused. They have no idea what they were doing or thinking about. Nothing makes any sense, and they might just get rather angry or hostile with you for waking them up. So the best thing to do when somebody is in that kind of a situation is lead them out of harm's way, lead them back to bed, lead them back into the house. Now, oftentimes, when this proceeds into adulthood, or beyond puberty, basically, what we find is there's something going on in the middle of the night that's causing sudden and abrupt disruptions to their sleep that causes them to have to shift gears from sleep to wake, but they don't make that shift correctly. Frequently, we'll find sleep apnea. Frequently, we'll find periodic limb movements, which is a lot like restless leg syndrome, or seizures sometimes will throw somebody into that kind of a thing, or loud noises, some medications. Sometimes having fever will prompt people to do these kind of things more often than they would have normally. Once we take a look at them, somebody with this problem, we frequently put them to the lab and see if we can find what's causing it. If we do, try to address the problem. If we don't find a cause and they're still doing it, and they seem like they're any risk to themselves or others, then there are some medications that we can try that sometimes will help somebody to sleep on through and not wake up and arouse partially in a sudden mode like that. So that's kind of a long answer, but that's that covers a really interesting area, and that area is called parasomnia. That's what we call anything that's associated with sleep, parasomnia.
All right. So again, the issue here is that I'm hearing, and just to go back over it to make sure our listeners and Ashley specifically are hearing it, is in young children, not so much of an alarm. Usually, you grow out of it, and you can just safely try to take care of the person and direct them back to where they want to be. But in adults, it raises flags that either medication or some other problem may be causing this disruption in sleep, and probably is a little bit more reasonable to think about looking into this further, is what I'm hearing you say.
That's correct. Okay. Particularly if you've already had a spell where you've walked outside, then right. You're at pretty high risk for getting hurt or hurting somebody.
Right. And so one of the misconceptions that I think about is that so even though they may be asleep, people can't actively drive cars reasonably safely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, and do complex motor activities.
Okay. All right. All right. And
sometimes there are some reports of having super abilities, mm-hmm. being able to run super fast or being super strong, mm-hmm. Super agility, and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's just reports of that. I'm not sure there's good explanations, but there's reports.
Right. Are individuals, particularly adults, easy to try to arouse or difficult? You said it's maybe not a good idea because the people would be very much confused as they come out of this state and may react as if they're confused in a difficult way. But are they easy to arouse or is it more difficult?
It's more difficult. Yeah, sometimes it's almost impossible to do. You have to be real aggressive to awaken them.
Okay. All right. Just mention also to our listeners, if you want more information about sleepwalking, there's a couple of links on our website, particularly at Medline Plus, where you can get some more information about sleepwalking or other sleep issues you may hear today. Well, let's get back to some basics. Tell us about phases of sleep. You've already mentioned that, or cycles, and what do we know about the underlying science and the natural history of sleep over time? Those are a lot of questions, but I'd like to get basic information, too.
Okay. I don't think sleep has changed a whole lot over time in the humans. Evolution-wise, it has changed a lot. But basically, when we go to sleep, we go in. There's two main phases of sleep. One's REM and one's non-REM. In the non-REM phase, there's stages 1, 2, and 3. There used to be 4, but as of just last year, we've cut it down to 3. And the first phase of sleep makes up 5 to 15% of the whole night. And the stage 1 of sleep is a light and transitional phase of sleep. It's kind of the phase that you're in where you kind of still hear people coming in and out of the room. If somebody was to say you were asleep, you'd say, no, I wasn't. And then say, yeah, you were snoring over there. Your eyes were closed. You were asleep. That's phase 1. And most of us have experienced that. It's transitional. Stage 2 is where we spend about 50% of our night. And that's good sleep. It's restorative sleep. It's not as restorative as deep sleep, and not restorative in the same way that REM is restorative. But a lot of people live on predominantly stage 2 and do reasonably well. Stage 3 is what we call deep sleep, or delta sleep. It's used synonymously there. And interestingly enough, when we're first born, we have most of our delta sleep, deep sleep at that phase. And we do well with the amount of deep sleep until we're about 16 years old. And then, unfortunately, the amount of deep sleep we get starts to decline. And as we get on up into years, for instance, when we get to 40 or 50, we may only be experiencing 15% of the night in deep sleep. And get on up to 70 or 80, we may be lucky if we get, 1 to 5% of the night in deep sleep. The deep sleep tends to restore our physical bodies more so than the brain. The REM sleep is an incredibly fascinating phase of sleep that resembles wake in all the physiologic factors as far as heart rate and breathing, and even the brain waves resemble wake waves. And this was, interestingly enough, it was just discovered in the 1980s. REM sleep was. We didn't even know what was going on. And REM stands for rapid eye movements. And if you look at somebody when they're dreaming, you can see their eyes darting back and forth under their lids, and that's rapid eye movements. And the thought is that we're watching the activities in our dream, and that's what's causing the eyes to dart back and forth. But during this time, what's happening in REM sleep is we're making associations with everything that we've learned and smelled and heard and read and felt, all those things we experience as humans during the day. We're taking all of those things, we're running them back through the computer, and the brain is making associations with other things that we know and have experienced, and that's how memories are made. And that's what's going on during REM sleep. Now, there's a lot of other things going on during REM sleep, but those are some of the more fascinating things. REM sleep makes up about 20% of the night for everybody, every age, except for infants. Newborns, it makes up another 50%. But it stays pretty steady the rest of our lives.
Even into the elderly, there's not a big change. It's more that early in life that there's a significant change with age.
That's right, okay. In infancy only.
Okay.
And the elderly still get about 20% of the night in REM sleep.
Mm-hmm. You'd mentioned earlier that memories and things are affected by lack of sleep. So it's like there's a recapitulation or reorganization of all the things that have happened, and it's kind of I get the picture of the brain kind of making all these connections and making it easier to catch up with what the association is. That smell reminds me of this place, and this name reminds me of these things, and how we can retrieve our memories. So that all kind of makes sense, and it is, I guess, somewhat like a computer in how that analogy works. All right. We have another couple of email questions come in. This comes from a gentleman named Will. He is a mechanical engineer. He says, I have restless leg syndrome. He says, I'm sure you guys must know that it makes sleep pretty darn near impossible. I've consulted with local physicians and had the usual tests, some confirming that I had normal iron and a low ferritin level. And you might want to comment on that. And then the problem is being effectively addressed with a medication called Requip. I'm not familiar with how it's pronounced, but I can't help but wishing there was a way to get off of this stuff. Has there been any advancements in understanding restless syndromes and possible permanent cures?
Restless leg syndrome, unfortunately, is one of the most underdiagnosed conditions that are around. It's always fascinated me that docs don't tend to address it very often, but I was in primary care at one time, too, and I didn't tend to address it. And I think the reason is because until more recently, we didn't know a whole lot about it. But it's a neurological condition, and what it is we have this unyielding urge to move. This urge to move is the main definition of restless legs. And it tends to come on in the evening, so it's a circadian issue, meaning sun up, sun down. It tends to be worse in the evening. It tends to be worse when we're in a reclined or a sedated situation. If we're kicked back in our recliners and we're relaxing, we're tuning down, it tends to be worse. And the fourth criteria is that it tends to get better if we get up and walk on our legs. And those four criteria right there, the urge to move, it's worse in the evening, it's worse if we're in a rested position, and it gets better if we walk, is the way to diagnose restless legs. There is no test for restless leg syndrome. It's all a historical diagnosis. Now, some people describe that urge to move as pain, but most people don't. Most people that I talk to have a real hard time putting it into words. All kinds of different descriptions, like Pepsi-Cola boiling in my veins, worms crawling under my skin, pinpricks, all kinds of different things. But most people say it's not painful. It's just real uncomfortable. It tends to run in families, definitely tends to run in families. And it's a bimodal disease, meaning you can get it as a child or you can get it a little bit later in life, a 40 to 50 onset. It tends to be associated with low iron levels, and it's not really the iron, it's the ferritin, just as Will mentioned. Ferritin is a protein that we measure that tends to give us an idea of what the iron storage is in our body. So if ferritin is low, then that means our iron overall is low. Even if a bunch floating in the blood, if it's not stored, we tend to have these complications. But it's not always with low ferritin. Most people don't have low ferritin. But if you do have it, replacing your iron tends to improve restless legs a lot. It gets worse with renal disease, particularly people that are on dialysis, and most of that's also iron-related. Gets worse in pregnancy. Again, that's iron-related. The treatment at this point in time is Requip or any other dopamine-related medication. Anything that improves the availability and utility of dopamine will help this disease. Now, dopamine is one of a handful of neurological chemicals that help our brain to communicate from cell to cell. And dopamine has to do with our motor movements. And in fact, dopamine is the chemical that gets low in Parkinson's disease. But this disease is not related to Parkinson's disease, and that scares a lot of people. But because of that connection, Requip and Mirapex, the other drug like this, are both Parkinson's drugs. So that scares a lot of people because they think, I don't want to take that drug. You know, this must be Parkinson's disease, but it's not. It just has that connection to it. The best treatment right now that we've got for restless legs is correcting the dopamine and increasing its availability by using Requip or Mirapex or Sinemet or some of those types of medications. There's tons of research going on in restless legs, and in Will's case, I know he'd much rather not take any kind of a chemical, but as of right now, there's not anything that's better than these medications, if the ferritin level is right.
How about the... Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say that in 85% of the people that have restless leg syndrome, it will carry over into their night. And when it carries over into their night, as soon as they go unconscious into sleep, this restlessness will go away. You know, getting to sleep is difficult because of the restlessness, as Will has referred to. For some people, that's just destructive as all get out. Once you're asleep, though, the restlessness goes away, and now they develop this periodic movements, and that's where we get the term periodic PLM, periodic limb movement disorder. And it's very related to this. It's treated in about the same way, but it's just recurrently through the night. There'll be intermittent muscle twitches, jerks, or contractions of any set of muscle in the foot, the leg, the hip, the arm. It may be just quick. It may be a kind of a contraction for a prolonged period of time, then it will relax. Most people do some degree of that anyway, but when we're watching somebody sleep and we're watching their brain waves go along nice and smooth, and they do one of those movements, and then their brain waves speed up real fast, like they just woke up, and then they go back to sleep. Then they move, and their brain waves speeds up, and they go back to sleep. That's causing recurrent disruptions to their sleep, and that's a cause of daytime sleepiness and sleep deprivation. So all that ties together, those two conditions do.
Yeah. A couple of questions come to my mind, and one perhaps Will's as well, is that I guess the natural history, as I hear you talking about, is this is a lifelong problem, and that it's really, in a sense, not a sleep problem. It's a neurologic problem that interferes with sleep, and hopefully often it gets better as you go to sleep, except for some of these exceptions. Are those reasonable questions to ask and clarify?
Yeah, I guess you could say that, because most of this does happen when you are awake, but it does get worse around sleep, and it has the connection with PLMs through sleep, so that's why it's addressed through the sleep medicine world.
Yeah. And it's likely to be a lifelong problem.
It's likely to, absolutely. Okay. There are tons of folks that it just automatically suddenly goes away, you know, and that's a great thing, but...
So when you talk about iron, and I've heard about the association with ferritin and iron before, it's not like the vast majority of people who have restless leg syndrome, once they are treated, that resolves or cures their problem. It just seems to be an associated aggravating factor, more or less.
On the ferritin?
Yeah, yes.
Well, no, actually, if they do have a low ferritin, if they correct their ferritin level by... Uh-huh. supplementing iron, they've got a good chance that the symptoms are going to go away.
Oh, okay. All right. But not everyone with a low ferritin has restless legs, and many people with restless legs may not have a low ferritin.
You hit it.
Okay.
Yep.
So it's an associated problem. How about children? I'm a pediatrician, so I'm always thinking, what about kids? And it seems to me I haven't directly made that diagnosis, but I've had a number of families where I've talked to adults who've been diagnosed, and they mention that they see similar stuff in their children. At this point, it hasn't been an issue I've addressed they've never asked me about specifically as far as treatment, but what are your comments about that? You seem to imply that it probably is present in kids and perhaps even more underdiagnosed.
Absolutely. Well, here's the problem with restless legs in kids. As I just mentioned, restless legs is strictly a historic diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to have a child tell you that they've got this unrelenting urge to move their legs.
Right.
And they have to be able to associate it to the onset of sleep, you know, or, you know, rest at night and sitting down and tell you it gets better. Most kids aren't able to tell you that, or they certainly haven't noticed those things. So it's pretty hard to get that diagnosis from a child. But there are ways to do it. Just talking to them and getting information from the parents. And then if there's a family history, you're more suspicious. I tell you something that's interesting about children. They found a few years ago that if you look at all the children who have been diagnosed and treated for ADD or ADHD, attention deficit disorder, that with hyperactivity, out of all the kids that are on treatment for that, approximately 25% of them don't have that as a primary diagnosis at all. It turns out that they're sleep deprived. And if you go looking at the reason they're sleep deprived, a large percentage of them, it's because of periodic limb movements or restless legs.
Okay.
So, you know, that's pretty significant. 3% of all children will have sleep apnea. 10% of all children will snore. Mm-hmm. So that's all very real stuff in the kiddos. Mm-hmm. It's just hard to find them.
Mm-hmm. So as pediatrician and parents, we should keep an open mind about sleep disorders as being a contributing factor to other issues that are happening to children.
Absolutely. Because, mm-hmm. you know, if you or I get a sleep disorder, don't get enough sleep, we're going to be sleepy. And, you know, we'll want to lay down, we'll mm-hmm. be lazy, we're going to close our eyes. But children don't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, children, if they get sleepy, they're out of sleep, unfortunately, they don't close their eyes and lay down and go to sleep. They get irritable and cranky and misbehave and that kind of stuff. And kids at school, they get hyperactive. So it can be real misleading in a child. And what you're saying, what you're looking at in a child trying to decide if they're sleepy or not, if they're acting like that, you say, well, if you're not sleepy, they never go to sleep. They're just always irritable. But that could be part of the problem.
I always like to hit misconceptions, and here's one that I think is a misconception, and it's often, as in this case with misconceptions, we're trying to hit somebody while they're down. Pharmaceutical companies are taking lots of hits now for a lot of reasons, but one of them that I suspect is not real is that I've heard this discussion that sleep disorders such as restless leg syndrome are not real entities, that they've been invented by pharmaceutical companies so they could sell their medications. You care to respond to that kind of claim?
Ask Will what he thinks about that.
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking when you find somebody that has really got the problems. It's kind of, you know, we're becoming more and more aware of these issues rather than they're being invented by somebody to sell a product, which is always a risk, I guess. But that's not my understanding at all.
You know, restless legs, so many people don't want to talk about it because they don't think there's an answer for it. They don't think there's anything wrong with that. They hate it. They're miserable with it. They may be distracted with it every single night of their life, and they fight with it. I remember seeing a video when I was doing my training of a guy who laid down for a sleep test, and he laid there for a minute, and then he reached down by the bed, got a baseball bat, and started banging on his legs, and that's how he handled his pain at night. So everybody's different on that, and they just don't think that there's anything to be done about it, so they don't pursue it. But those that have it and have it significantly, they're quite miserable with it.
Yeah. We've got another call come in, and I've got another email. I think I want to keep going with these questions because they do lead us to a better understanding and of what all we do know and what we can offer. So this is from Diane. She says, please discuss sleep problems that appear to affect senior citizens. Would a trip to a sleep clinic help determine an elder person's sleep difficulties? I suspect, and she asked the question about Medicare and whether or not they would pay for these visits. And then another paragraph, middle-aged people who don't seem to sleep well, no problem going to sleep, but frequently wake up at night, and then difficulty getting back to sleep, waking up tired. Those are a couple of big issues, but perhaps you might want to address those.
Sure. Yeah, those are big issues. The elderly have a lot of specific issues of their own. So in general, elderly people do sleep poorly. They rest poorly, and there's reasons for it. Some are natural and some are not natural. Those that are natural is as we age, all of our mechanisms, physiologic mechanisms, not all of them, but most of them, decrease in their sharpness and their acuity. And so does our abilities to sleep and alternate between wake and sleep and have a clear-cut delineation between our sleep stages. So as we get older, it's more difficult to get consolidated, restful sleep. We get less deep sleep as we get older. And it's interesting, a fallacy, you know, we want to talk about fallacies, is that old people don't need as much sleep. And that's just not true at all. They actually need a little bit more sleep than they did when they were 40 or 50. And when I'm talking old, I'm talking 70 or 80-ish and up. Instead of needing, say, 7.5 hours, now they may need 8 or 8.5 hours is what they need. The problem is they have a harder time getting it because they can't go to sleep well because that mechanism's not as sharp as it used to be. Once they do get to sleep, they have a hard time staying asleep well for the same reasons. And then you add on all the other distractors in their life, such as chronic illnesses, chronic medications, and all the side effects to medications. Chronic pain is a common issue. And then their brain sleep pattern may change a little bit, what we call their circadian rhythm. When we're middle-aged like us right now, pretty much we're sleepy by 10 and we're up by 6, you know, just throwing out some average examples. With adolescents, their sleep phase is delayed, so they're not really sleepy until midnight or 2 in the morning, and they are not ready to end sleep until 10 or 12. It has nothing to do with the fact they went to bed late. It's just their brain's not done yet based on sun up, sun down. The brain's not done sleeping. As we age, that same sleep phase may advance a little bit so that instead of being sleepy at 10, they may be truly sleepy at 7 or 8, but then they're wide awake and ready to go at 4 or 5 in the morning. And they're perfectly happy with that. As long as they stay in that phase, they sleep great, and they get relatively good restoration. But the fact is as we get older, we still have to get the hours of sleep. So let's say we need 8 hours of sleep as an elderly person when we only needed 7.5 as a middle-aged person. It may take us 10 or 12 hours of laying in bed in order to get that sleep now because of losing the efficiency of our sleeping mechanism. So elderly do need sleep more, and if you can't get it all, if you can't get all 8 in the 10 hours in bed, so let's say you only got 7, you may have to get another nap during the day to get that other hour to really feel good, and that's why, that's part of the reason a lot of them nap, is in order to get the total amount of sleep. But elderly just have a lot of things complicating, particularly when you start throwing on their illnesses and their medications.
Okay. So does Medicare help reimburse for those evaluations, and would it help to at least seek a sleep specialist to discuss the possibility of a sleep study?
Absolutely. If there's any snoring or any witnessed pausing, or if they seem to sleep adequate time but they're still horribly sleepy during the day, absolutely needs to be looked into. And, yes, Medicare does handle sleep disorders, and they handle purchasing CPAP for those that have sleep apnea. It's not an issue with them at all.
Okay. We do have a telephone call as well. Bill, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, just wanted to make a comment about the symptoms for restless leg are so nebulous that people around you tend to consider you a little bit nuts. And pretty soon you begin to believe it yourself. I'm third generation in the family, and so I diagnosed about 8 years ago, and it's been I'm on Mirapex now and functioning, but there was a couple of years where I wasn't.
Tell us about your experiences that led you to call.
I researched when I first was diagnosed, and so I know as much as I can about it, but that doesn't help when nobody understands those symptoms. My primary care doctor didn't have a clue, and I happened to see a show on television that described the symptoms perfectly, and then got into a sleep clinic.
Dr. Cates, comments?
Well, that's great what he's saying. That perfectly supports everything I was just saying a while ago. Primary care docs really don't fully understand it, and so many people just don't understand the symptoms when you describe them. Bill, how would you describe, could you put in words what you feel, just out of curiosity?
The jerking and the legs after I go to sleep, in the evening, from about 7 till midnight, there are some symptoms. I also have peripheral neuropathy on the tops of my hands and feet, and that's been probably the most painful. At times my legs just hurt, as well as all the tingling feelings at times.
Everybody will describe it totally differently, what they experience, so it's always real interesting.
All right, Bill, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
When we talk about myths, maybe this is an urban legend as well. Diane, who had previously emailed, also had on her list, do people like Bill Clinton, who is reported not to sleep more than a few hours a night, are people like that going to end up with more health problems? And then I can let you use that to segue into some of the problems we've already mentioned, like sleep disorders being a predisposing factor for depression, heart failure, perhaps even cancer, some recent studies.
Yeah, that's correct. Well, when somebody tells me they only need 2 hours of sleep at night, I have to step back for a minute and start looking at the whole picture, because that's typically not true. The range of sleep that's considered to be normal ranges from 4 to 12, and that's a bell curve, meaning there's just a few people at 4 hours needs and a few people at 12-hour needs, but there are ones there. And then this curve peaks at 7.5 to 8, which is what most people need. And then you can be anywhere on either side of that peak. So I believe somebody tells me they only need 4 hours of sleep and they function great with it. I run into people like that, and I'm jealous as I can be. Wish I could do that, but I can't. So most of us can't. And when somebody tells me they only sleep for 2 hours, they're either exaggerating or they have a real strong, what we call, sleep state misperception, where they don't really understand when they are going to sleep and when they're actually asleep and when they're not, because the brain goes unconscious and you really have no track of time whatsoever. And usually when people tell me that, we'll do some things and I can show them objectively that, well, I know you think you only slept for 2 hours, but looky here, you've got 4.5 or 5 hours here that you were asleep. Oh, my gosh, how did that happen? I can't believe it. Okay.
Do some people who only say they sleep 2 or 3 hours a night also get 1 or 2 or 3 short naps during the day that also may suffice to, and it's the total amount of sleep per day that is really important?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay.
Yep, you can always make up sleep by napping. Right. It's never as efficient as getting in one large lump, but you can certainly pick up the total hours piecemeal.
Yeah, I've read, in fact, recently, again, some information about Winston Churchill, and this is, you know, well documented by other people. He had lots of people around him, aides, people he had dictating to throughout the night and so forth that would substantiate that he didn't need a lot of sleep, but he took several naps during the day, was well known for doing that as well. So his total amount of sleep was a little less well documented, but he often was up very late and then slept late, though, too, so... what about the association of sleep deprivation or not getting enough sleep with some of these illnesses like we've talked about, and even perhaps mentioning some of the more recent literature suggesting it may also be a related, choose my words carefully, to cancer?
Yeah, that's real carefully, because that's a real scary area.
Yep.
And you cause panic on that one. But absolutely, there seems to be some associations, and I really can't say I'm up to date on the specifics of the findings, but every time I go to a sleep meeting, I'll hear somebody present something new on something that they have found. There's no doubt that the immune system is affected, like we mentioned earlier. The growth hormone, if somebody is deprived sleep, growth hormone is decreased, and that's seen particularly in children. Cortisol levels are affected, as we mentioned a while ago. Let's see, what else? I know another one. They found that a study looked at a bunch of nurses, and this is fairly recent also, looked at a bunch of nurses, and they found that those that had excessive sleep versus those with normal sleep had a higher mortality, meaning more of them would die early than those that had the normal amount of sleep. And now that's a new frontier. You know, I mean, who would have expected that and who could explain that? But the body is supposed to get a certain amount of sleep, and that's it.
In those kind of associations, you always got to ask yourself, and I'm just asking our leaders, to listeners, to keep an open mind. It may be that whatever causes people to sleep excessively is a risk factor for making them more likely to die. It may work the other way around, right?
That's right.
So we want to keep that in mind. Okay. How about sleep issues and bedwetting, particularly in children? I'd like your comments about that association.
Okay, and that the same association goes across to adults too.
Okay,
it's true that when somebody goes into a really deep phase of sleep, and they're unable to disconnect from the sleep phase into a conscious enough phase that they can get up and go relieve their bladder, they may just go ahead and have an accident. So enuresis, or wetting the bed, is listed under some of the different sleep disorders, the big 88 sleep disorders that are out there, and that's why. And it can be in children or adults. So if I see somebody that's having a lot of bedwetting, I'm usually wondering about, why can't they wake up properly? So why are they so deeply, why are they so sleepy that they're in such a deep phase of sleep that they can't wake themselves out of it?
Yeah, and it's certainly true in my experience that the kids, as they begin to grow out of it, are much more likely to bedwet again if they're sleep deprived for some reason.
Yes, same kind of problem.
Right.
They go in that deep phase and don't shift well.
Right. A listener wants to know about sleep aids that are over the counter. Do they work? Are they safe? And what would you have to say about those?
They do work. There's one trick to them, and the producers of the sleep aids won't like me when I say the trick to them, but they all have the same, most all of them have the same ingredient, and that's diphenhydramine, which is otherwise known as Benadryl. And most every sleep aid that you can get over the counter out there, that's the active ingredient. So it does work. Benadryl does work well at 25, 50 milligrams, sometimes higher. It tends to play out quickly after a couple of weeks' usage. You won't get much benefit from it. It tends not to make you quite as sleepy. But I tell you, the problem with those, they're really more dangerous than some of the prescribed sleep aids, because in studies, they've taken people that were sleepy and had hangover effects from drugs and did reflex testing on them, let them drive simulated cars and see what the reflexes were on things, and check their memory and their cognitive skills. And what they found were people that had been on Benadryl thought they were fine, did real poorly on those skills, whereas somebody that had been on Ambien or Sonata or something of that sort, they realized that they were not fine, and they admitted they were not fine. And when they did finally say they felt fine, they did fine on the test. That's scary to me. You know, if you think you're okay and you're not, then, you know, who's going to tell you not to go drive or whatever you're going to do?
Yeah.
But they do work. They do work, which was the question.
I know even in the allergy literature, just to focus on this some more, is that there's a strong recommendation not to use the older antihistamines that are more sedative, like Benadryl, and to go to and use the non-sedative, which are now also somewhat over-the-counter, like Zyrtec and Claritin, because of the exact factor. They correlate very well to people who are already intoxicated, and they're using those to be driving. So it's not a good recommendation. What about melatonin?
Melatonin is really interesting. It has not really received a lot of strength in the medical world because they can't make a lot of real evidence-based decisions on it. But melatonin seems to be beneficial for those people that are having a sleep cycling problem, particularly people that are on shift work, you know, that work late, they're out of their circadian rhythm, or people that work, they get up when it's dark and inside a house all day or a building all day, then they go home and it's already dark. Those kind of people are losing the stimulation of the sunshine, which is what sets our circadian clock. So melatonin is the chemical in our brain that goes up and down based on sunshine exposure and sets our clock for it's time to be sleepy and it's time not to be sleepy. So that's how melatonin works in our brain, and adding supplemental melatonin seems to have very little benefit in general, except for pretty much in that one little small group of folks.
Okay. We really have only 2 minutes left. There's a caller who I'm going to just give you what it looks like to me he wants to talk about so I can save a little time. Wants to know the best time for high school students to go to school. So it addresses this issue, which we see talked about all the time, and you've mentioned already about high school. How do you address that issue with these high school students who may have a different sleep time cycle?
Oh, wow. I wish we didn't only have 2 minutes for that. That's a wild area, and it's a major area for our society to fix. Right now we have all kinds of issues going on in children that are sleep-deprived based on their schoolwork, their habits, they're staying up late, working on the Internet, talking on the phone, and whatever. So children are shifted on their sleep time needs. So what happens are the kids that are the most shifted are those that or just beyond puberty, those that are in high school. And those, unfortunately, are the ones that are having to be at school at 5:30 or 6 for band mm-hmm. practice and football practice, and they don't get home from those things until 6 or 7 at night, and then they still have to study, and then they got to get up in the morning to catch the bus to go back to school. It's a real problem. What they have done in some states, and I believe it was Wisconsin, I'm not sure about that, but they did a pilot study where they took different age kids and looked at them, and they put them on a later start date, like 9 o'clock start time. And the findings were fascinating, but as you would imagine, the academic performance went up. Mm. But the social skills went up as far as behavioral issues throughout the course of the day. The kids were acting better, less discipline issues. Retention in school was better, as you would imagine. But get a load of this. Pregnancy rate went down. Pregnancy rate went down. Mm-hmm. And the thought on that is with enough sleep, the kids were able to make more responsible decisions mm-hmm. and were more cognitively aware of what was going on and what they were thinking and doing at the moment. But it's a big deal. It needs mm-hmm. to be fixed. But I tell you the problem, just real quick. The problem is we're a double-working parent society now. And what happens is everybody's got to get to work by 8 or 9, so right. kids got to go into school.
Right, right. And the cost of changing the buses and so forth. Well, thanks very much, Dr. Case. This has been just very interesting, and I appreciate your time.
Well, good. Well, I sure enjoyed it. I'll be glad to do it any time.
All right. Thanks again. Have a good afternoon.
Bye-bye.
Next week, we're going to be talking about exercise just in time for your New Year's resolution. So why don't you tune in and listen Monday, December 22nd at 2 p.m. And we'll be back at that particular time. This is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a good day. Your Health
Connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.